Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Religion and science are often at odds, and nowhere more so than at the center of Alan Lightman's new novel, Ghost. Lightman, a scientist and a writer who's fascinated by religion, but is not a believer himself, tells the story of David Kurzweil, a rationalist who works at a funeral home. One day he sees something, a vapor or a ghost, out of the corner of his eye, and it makes him question all that he holds true. Joining me now in studio is Alan Lightman, a theoretical physicist and novelist who teaches at MIT. He's the author of four previous novels, including the international bestseller Einstein's Dreams. He was the first professor at MIT to hold joint appointments in physics and humanities. His new novel is Ghost, which the Los Angeles Times calls elegantly provocative and understated. So nice to have you here, Alan. Thanks for coming.
Nice to be here, Jane.
So I asked you right before we went on, this is your 12th book, and you said, approximately. You've done a lot of them.
Well, it's like children, you know, if you have two or three, you can keep track of them.
So take us from the top. Tell us about the protagonist in Ghost, David Kurzweil.
Well, you gave a pretty good capsule summary of the book. David is a middle-aged man, I think in his early 40s. He loves to read. He has training in accounting. He's not particularly ambitious, but he's curious about the world. He is divorced and has been estranged from his ex-wife for 8 or 10 years. He has a girlfriend. He has a mother. And after working in a bank for many years, he gets summarily fired and then takes a temporary job in a mortuary. And that's where he has this metaphysical experience, this vision.
Right. So one night he sees something, this vision, this experience, this supernatural event, and it's very unsettling to him.
Yes, it's terribly upsetting to him because he is a person, although not a scientist by any means, he has sort of a rational view of the world. He believes that the world is all physical, that every phenomena obeys a cause and effect relation, and what he sees or thinks he sees, he's pretty sure does not fit into that category.
It just rocks his world. It causes him to question everything that he knows or has ever believed.
That's right. And it also causes all of his relationships with people to change, with his employer, with his mother, with his girlfriend. All of these relationships change because he has been changed by this experience. And he tries to talk himself out of it, but he can't quite talk himself out of it.
His relationships change in a good way.
Well, I think in a good way. I'm not completely sure, but I mean, relationships are complicated. But I think that he sees things in people that he didn't see before, and they certainly react to him differently.
So how did this event shape then his change in thinking? I mean, what happened after he saw this, that this thing that he could not explain?
Well, he tells himself over and over that he doesn't believe in the supernatural, but I think that he does feel that he has been searching for some hidden order in the world, and he feels like maybe it has been revealed to him. You know, a lot of us feel special in some way. We feel like that we may be able to see things that other people can't see, and I think he grows more sensitive to people as well. He begins to pay more attention to the world around him, to sort of look underneath things.
So in some ways it's an answer for a question he's been sort of feeling or wondering
an answer.
About.
It's an answer in a way, but he doesn't know what kind of an answer because he still doesn't know exactly what happened, and he struggles with this throughout the book, trying to understand what it was that he saw. But it is a kind of an answer, I guess.
So you have always been interested in the intersection of science and religion, and I wonder in the context of the story that you just told and tell in the novel, Ghost, this conflict between the two, can you explain it a little bit?
Well, it's a very interesting relationship to me. I think science and religion are two of the most powerful forces that have shaped civilization. And from time to time, they are in confrontation with each other. What is fascinating to me is that no matter how much science advances, and we now understand the universe back to the first billionth of a second and even earlier, the fraction of people who are religious, who believe in God, who believe in an afterlife, who believe in miracles, that fraction hasn't really changed substantially over time. Mm-hmm. I think a recent Gallup poll showed that over 80% of the American public believes in miracles and believes in an afterlife. And that suggests to me that these two great endeavors operate in different spheres, the physical sphere and the spiritual sphere. And there's no amount of physical argument that you can make that would really be relevant to someone who believes in the spiritual sphere. The two spheres, they're oil and water. You know, they're completely separate, and they complement each other in a way, but you can't, one cannot negate the other. I don't think that either science or religion is ever going to dominate over the other and win a battle, because they operate in different continents, the physical and the spiritual.
So how does your character David reconcile the physical and the spiritual in his journey in the novel Ghost?
Well, I believe that in wrestling with this experience that he had and with talking to other people, some who are believers and some who aren't, that he begins to acknowledge for him that there might be a spiritual dimension. There are various people that he comes into contact with, including a whole society of people who believe in the supernatural. And some of those people are kooks and some of them aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the people that he knows who are scientists are very dogmatic, and some of them are more flexible. So I think there's a range of dogmatism and flexibility both in believers and non-believers.
I'm interested that as a scientist, you've talked about your interest in why people believe what they believe, in the psychology
of it. It's a fascinating question. People either believers or non-believers, and I'm really talking about the supernatural here, but I believe that belief in God is really a category of the supernatural, most people's concepts of God anyway. That people, either believers or non-believers, are very entrenched in their belief. And no amount of evidence or argument is going to cause them to change their belief. In general, people are entrenched in these beliefs, and it represents something very visceral and emotional about a person's relationship to the world. American psychologist and philosopher William James, who did one of the definitive studies on religious belief, was looking, this is back around 1900, and why people have religious belief. And a couple of the reasons, which are both psychological, are religious belief brings us a sense of comfort. If we believe that there's some intelligence out there who cares about us, if there's some kind of absolute enduring truth in the world, that was his phrase, then it feels that there's some purpose to our existence. There's some meaning in the world. And he also pointed out that religious belief gives people a sense of power.
And control.
If you feel that your prayer and ritual have some influence on the world, it gives you a feeling of power and control. And what is a wonderful irony there is that scientists are motivated by the same reason to have a sense of power and control. And in the case of science, to be able to make predictions, to be able to reduce the world of experience to a small set of laws that always operate, that are repeatable, which you can quantify, you can write mathematical equations for, you can make predictions. And that gives scientists, and when I say scientists, I mean not just people who have PhDs in physics, but I mean everyone who has a scientific, rational, causal view of the world. It gives all of those people a sense of power and control that you can learn things and you can make predictions. So both the religious group and the non-religious group are motivated by the same desire to have a sense of a control in this strange universe that we find ourselves in, to have power, and yet they adopt totally different strategies for achieving that control.
What do you make of that? What do you make of those two paths?
I think it's wonderful. I mean, as you said at the beginning, I'm not a religious person myself. I place myself somewhere between agnostic and atheist. But I think it speaks to the richness and complexity of the human mind, to me. And that richness is wonderful, and it should be preserved just like different ethnicities should be preserved on Earth.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook. My guest today is theoretical physicist and novelist Alan Lightman. I posed the question earlier, right before the break, that I wanted you to actually answer. How do you reconcile trust in science and belief in God, and must they be mutually exclusive?
It's a wonderful question, and of course there's a range of religious belief. There is a kind of religious belief that is completely consistent with science, and that is, if you believe in God, and God can be all powerful, as long as God does not intervene once the universe is created, as long as God can create the laws of nature and the design of the universe, but as long as God then sits down, so to speak, then that kind of religious belief is completely compatible with science. What science requires is a set of laws of nature or rules that govern phenomena that are repeatable, that are predictable, that follow cause and effect relations. If, however, you believe in a God that from time to time intervenes and violates the laws of nature, for example, a God that could perform a miracle at this instant that could make this table suddenly start floating for no reason, then that kind of belief is completely incompatible with science, because then science cannot make predictions based upon laws of nature. There's some external agency that can act at will in an unpredictable manner, and that would put scientists out of work. So that latter belief is sometimes, some people call it the interventionist version of religious belief, and that is strictly incompatible with science. And I have a number of scientific colleagues who are religious and devout, and the way that they reconcile their religious belief with science, with their science, is that they don't envision a God who continually performs miracles. God created the universe for them. God created the laws of nature. But then God steps back and lets the universe unfold according to those laws of nature, which are reducible in terms of the equations that physicists and chemists and biologists use, and the experiments that they do, all are discoverable by human beings by their science.
So then the obvious follow-up in my mind to you is, what's been your path? What's your experience? You told us earlier that you fall somewhere between an agnostic and an atheistic. How did you find that path? What was your journey like?
Well, my own personal view is that science can explain the physical universe. and that we do not need to resort to any outside agency, that there are laws of nature that we don't know them all now, and science is a process of discovering those laws. I do, however, believe that there are things bigger than me. I believe that there are truths in the world that I believe in living deliberately and thinking about my values, and those are aspects that many people associate with spirituality. So I consider myself a spiritual person, and yet I don't believe in an intelligent being outside of science who created the universe.
And has this been a progression? Has this been an evolution? Have you always felt this?
I've always felt this way. And I think that there was a study done recently by a sociologist named Elaine Eklund at the University of Buffalo, who studied the religious belief in scientists at top universities. And she found that she found about half of the scientists had religious beliefs. But she found that they didn't change their beliefs as a result of their scientific training. That it's very rare that a person who has religious beliefs then changes those beliefs as a result of a scientific training. They're beliefs that are engendered at a very young age. They're influenced by the family, by the community, by the particular psychology of the individual, and they don't really change that much during life, is what she found.
Back to the novel, Ghost. Do you see the experience of David, the protagonist, your main character? Do you see what he's going through as something that you might, at some point, wish might happen to you?
Well, if I saw something supernatural, yes, I would certainly question everything I believe in. There is a character in the novel, Ronald Micklewheat, who's a chemist, and he gets into an argument with David, and David is pushing Ronald to admit that if he saw something supernatural, that he would accept it, because, after all, scientists are supposed to be open to whatever happens. And Ronald finally says, if I saw something that I thought was supernatural, I would just assume that there was some law of nature that I didn't yet understand but would discover it. And it would be a natural phenomena in that case. So there is no circumstance in which Ronald Micklewheat would be willing to acknowledge the existence of the supernatural, even if something happened to him that he couldn't explain at all. He would just assume that it was a scientific phenomena that he would later discover its the origins of it and the reason for it.
Will you read a piece from the novel Ghost?
I will read a piece.
Set it up, if you would, for us.
Well, this scene takes place fairly early in the book. The main character, David, has seen the thing that other people call a ghost. He's the only person who saw it, and he never calls it a ghost, but he saw this strange phenomena. And he's beginning to tell people about it and beginning to struggle with its significance. And he is visiting his girlfriend Ellen at her apartment when this scene starts. With the fragrance of her all over him, they lie side by side in her bed. Slowly, David begins to recover his mind. For a few minutes today, while he sat in the basement washroom, he had the fleeting sensation that whatever happened on April 23rd was it, or close to it. Has he been offered a glimpse of the meaning that always eluded him? The thing that he saw, whatever it was, surely meant something. It's frightened him, but it meant something. At times, he's felt the world opening up around him, shifting, cracks forming in the wall of experience, and he's been poised to see through those cracks. The supernatural he can't accept. But he does believe that there is something unseen behind common experience, some totality, which can be glimpsed only between the cracks. He's read that people near death understand something. What is it they understand? Do they understand the flash of their lives against the totality, against the infinity of time before and after their single chirp of life?
You know what it seems to me as you read that and as in the context of the novel as a whole? It seems Ghosts attempts to understand the emotional and the psychological basis of a quote-unquote religious experience without questioning the validity of that experience.
Yes, that's right. And I think in the book I did not really address the validity of the whether other people would recognize the experience. What I'm really interested in is the personal experience.
I want to go to the phones. Let some callers join our conversation. First, from Hadley, Massachusetts, Wayne is on the line. Wayne, welcome.
Thank you, and hello. I've come to the same places. I'm amazed at his description of your beliefs, Mr. Lightman, and it's where I've come from, evangelical background, and struggling with this. Over the years, I've heard explanations that human beings, the human species, understands the world mainly by telling stories. Lately, it's more science, too, but I think we still tell ourselves stories. And I'm wondering if religion and these questions we have are not our way of filling in the blanks until we do understand. Is religion and explanations that we give just our way of understanding consciousness, in a way?
Wayne, thank you.
Well, that's a wonderful comment, Wayne, and it's astute. And I think that we do make sense of the world around us by telling stories. Science is a kind of narrative with its own evidence and own methods of proof, and religion is another story. I think art is a story. A lot of human activities follow that pattern. It's a very astute comment.
Let me go back to the phones again for another call from Nashville, Tennessee. Hussein is on the line. Hussein, welcome. Hello.
Thank you for allowing me to come on. Earlier you said that science can't coexist with religion, only if there is a religion where God exists without interrupting with nature or something like that, correct? And
yeah.
There is a religion like this. Islam, you know, in Islam, natural law is created by God and stays that way, so God doesn't really interrupt nor interfere with nature. Instead, nature takes its course because everything has law, you know? And God sits back and he just pretty much watches us as we make choices. All God interferes with is, you know, the prophets and the guidance and so on. And we pretty much just either believe or not.
Hussein, thank you.
Yes, well, I think that the kind of religious belief that you've just described would be consistent with science. Science certainly can't prove what caused the origin of the universe. That is outside of the scope of science, as many interesting questions are. And the Islamic belief you described sounds to me completely consistent with science, the version that you told.
I'd like to change gears for a minute and ask you about the style of your writing and the process of your writing. Do you plot out your work? Do you let it flow as it will? How do you write a book?
Well, there's a big difference between writing a nonfiction book and a book of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
With nonfiction, you can do the equivalent of plotting it out. You can make an outline. You can make a logical argument, and you can research the material and know where you're going pretty much. I think it's dangerous to plot a novel too closely because you're not giving your characters room to come alive. And I think a good character in a novel has to have the ability to surprise the author. You can't, as an author, you shouldn't be telling your characters what to say at each moment. You should be listening to them talk. Allowing them to speak. And this is the way in which they come alive.
You know, another interesting part of this novel, I thought, was you start the book in first person. That's the first chapter. And then you switch gears, and the rest of the book is written in third person.
Yes. Well, the difference between first and third person is a mysterious difference, which I don't fully understand. but I think that I started the book and with the first person because I wanted the reader to feel the immediacy of David's torment. He's seen something that he doesn't understand. He's struggling in his own mind with it, and it was only a week ago when the first chapter starts, and I want the reader to feel the agony of that introspection. And the first person, I think, conveys that more immediately than the third person.
Hmm. We have so many calls. I want to get some more listeners in. Paul is in Woburn, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm very impressed you actually stole my thunder. I'm the first type of individual, the one who believes that at the instant of creation, God created all the laws of physics and science and chemistry, psychology, biology, and sits back and watches. He certainly could be an interventionist should he choose. However, if he did, it would I think it would actually diminish the power of God, because that would imply that he didn't get it right in the first time. So I'm very pleased to hear that your explanation, and I thought I was going to come in with something new and unusual, but apparently you've already covered it. But
Paul, thank you.
Well, that's a good comment. I'm certainly not the first person who envisioned that kind of God, but that is the kind of God that is compatible with science.
Marilyn is calling now from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Marilyn. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I was quite taken when I first heard that the story starts off with this man seeing a vapor. The reason I'm calling in is that I had an experience like that. My former husband was killed in a plane crash, and I had dreamed 6 weeks beforehand that was going to happen and didn't even tell him because I thought it was so utterly unlikely and impossible that it just escaped my mind. Mm. Then he was killed. And after the memorial service, I was sitting in my apartment just looking at a begonia plant, and it was the only time in my life I ever had such an experience. I absolutely saw a vapor come in, swirl, get large. I heard his voice. I heard him weeping. And I was neither, I didn't have a religious experience or experience of awe. I was transfixed. I don't know how long I sat there until that disappeared. And I never, ever had that happen again. And my conclusion, after years of thinking about this, was that, one, it tore up my entire version of reality. I thought that the time factor between the plane crash and my dream, etc., was amazing, and that I therefore understood nothing about time, that my concept of time is confined to what I, as a little human, can experience, and secondly, that what happened in terms of the vapor, et cetera, must mean that the universe is so multidimensional that the word multidimensional is only something that we humans can use because we don't really understand anything.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, my guest is Alan Lightman. His new novel is Ghost, and it examines the relationship between religion and science. I have lots of questions for you, so do our callers, about that, but I'd like to talk for a minute about something unrelated to the book, and that is your work, your wonderful work in Cambodia. I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about the Harpswell Foundation for women, for university women in Cambodia.
Well, a few years ago, a good friend of mine, Fred Lipp, who was a minister in Maine, took me to Cambodia to see some work that he was doing. And he's a very inspirational person. And I was he took me to some of the villages there that live in total poverty. And, of course, Cambodia was devastated in the 1970s by the ultra-communist organization, the Khmer Rouge, and all of the educated people were killed or starved to death. And I was overwhelmed by the sense of hope there, that in the midst of this terrible history, and it's the poorest country in Southeast Asia, that there's hope, and hope for education in particular. And that's when my wife and I formed this nonprofit, the Harpswell Foundation, and began raising money to help rebuild the educational infrastructure there in Cambodia. And of course, there are lots of other NGOs who are doing excellent work, and we're just one of many.
So what you do is you go there and you built a college dormitory for women, so they could come to the city to be educated. And before this, they really had no place to stay. They had no place to live. The men could bunk up in the city's temple or whatever, but the women were not allowed there. And so this is a place where they can come.
Yes. The colleges there don't provide housing for their students, which is something we all take for granted here,
right,
in dormitories. And the women particularly needed housing. And one of our first big projects was to build this dormitory, which serves six different universities in the country. And in addition to giving the young women their free room and board and free medical care, we also provide them in the university, in the dormitory, classes in English, classes in computers, weekly discussions of national and international events so they can learn their own history, and leadership seminars, because what we really want is these young women to be the next generation of leaders of the country.
And otherwise they might, you know, be rice farmers or brides in arranged marriages or whatever.
Yes, even the smartest of them would have a dismal future without this dormitory. And unfortunately, we can only help about 30 or 35 young women at a time. But someday, maybe I'll be able to build more dormitories.
Well, I've been interested in that because as I was reading about this and about you, this has really sort of taken over your life. You spend a great deal of time in this charity effort.
Yes. Well, like a lot of activities where you give to people, you receive much more than you give. And my family and I have gotten much more out of this than we've given.
You spoke somewhere that I read about the material wealth and the excess of American life, and how you go to places like Cambodia where you've built this dormitory for the women, and what a sharp focus that brings what we have into.
Yes, well, we're the most materialist country in the world, and we consume four times as much as any other country in terms of our per person. And I think especially with, the recent economic situation in the world and our tremendous debt, we're beginning, I think, to get glimmers of just how materialist we are. And every time I come back from Cambodia, the first thing I do, I go twice a year, is I go through my closet and I look at all of the clothes that I have that I don't need, and I look at all of the things that I have that I don't need. And when I buy a Coca-Cola, I think, that could be 3 days of food for someone in Cambodia, just the cost of that Coca-Cola. I get hypersensitive to my material wealth. And then after a few months, that feeling begins to wear off, and I get caught up again into the mindset of America. It's so easy to drift back into that mindset. And then I have to wait to my next trip to Cambodia when I become hypersensitized again to the amount of material wealth that we have here.
I was also struck by the first time that you went with your daughter to meet some of these villagers and how unprepared you were for the emotions that hit you.
Yes, my oldest daughter, Elise, and I have been traveling together to Cambodia almost every trip. And our first trip to a very small village, the women came up to us holding babies in their arms and said, please build a school here. I'm very sensitive to the phenomena in which Westerners go to underdeveloped countries and in an imperial way tell them what they need. And Elise and I instead wanted to listen to them and let them tell us what they needed. And they told us they want to build, they want us to help them build a school. They want to build a dormitory where women can live going to university.
Which is so interesting for all the needs, you know, clothing and food. It was the education.
It was the education. Yeah. To them, education is more precious than bread and water.
So I wonder if you could bring this back into the context of your work and your writing, how that's all affected you.
Well, I think a writer is affected by everything that he or she does, every experience in life. And this has been the most powerful experience of my life, the work in Cambodia. And it's a matter of listening. You know, that's a common thing. We're talking about listening to your characters talk. It's the same with listening to people in a country like Cambodia. Listen to them and let them tell you how you can help them.
So let's go back to the phones now. And from Maynard, Massachusetts, Andrea is calling. Andrea, go ahead. Hello, welcome.
Hello, great topic. I am a scientist, and I also consider myself extremely spiritual. However, I don't adhere to any organized form of religion. And the first point that I wanted to make is that I know it, many, many very spiritual people that do not are not necessarily religious. And the other point that I wanted to make is that I'm an immunologist. I've done basic research in immunology for many years, and I take science very seriously. And the more I understand biological systems, the more I believe in God, or whatever you want to call what I think is an underlying organizing principle that you can see in living beings. And I find it very interesting, the discussion between, or the fight between creationists and evolutionists. I think that the more you understand evolution, the more you come to an understanding of this organizing principle that is greater than us.
Mm. Andrea, thank you. You want to comment on that, Alan?
Well, that's a wonderful comment, and this belief that you have in an underlying organizing principle sounds very much like the language that William James used to describe the religious experience. He talked about an absolute and enduring truth and an unseen order in the world as beliefs that people have.
Michael is on the line now from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. Welcome to you.
Hi, Professor Lightman. Thank you for this enlightening talk. I would like to ask you about scientists, God, and miracles. My question is composed of two parts which are linked together. You mentioned that scientists who believe in God believe because this was their framework of belief, so to speak, since childhood, and science didn't change it. Isn't it fair to say that most prominent scientists, Einstein included, and even Newton, and modern-day scientists, their belief in God is a logical consequence of the deep understanding of science, especially what you see with the Big Bang? Because is there any other rational explanation for the causality and the Big Bang itself other than some other force, and you can call it any way you want, including God, behind this great miracle?
Michael, I'm going to cut you off because of time, but I know Alan wants to answer. He's vigorously shaking his head.
Well, I don't think that the belief in God is necessarily a logical consequence of deep understanding of nature. I mean, there are plenty of superb physicists like Steven Weinberg who understand nature as well as anyone who don't believe in God. The existence of the Big Bang, that phenomena also does not require the existence of God. There are many physicists who believe that the origin of the universe came out of what's called a quantum fluctuation quantum mechanics, general relativity, of some underlying space that was there before that that created many different universes. So I really think that these two spheres, the religious sphere and the scientific sphere, really do represent two different approaches to the world in which one must simply have a faith. I don't think that one is necessarily and logically led to the other.
Another call for you from Jim, who's in North Andover, Massachusetts. Welcome to you, Jim. Hi.
Hi, Gene. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Thanks for the discussion, Alan. That's great. I would say that I'm pretty well aligned, I would think, with your point of view, Alan, on things. And I was just wondering, though, one of the big questions is what happens to us after this world? And I struggle with that in terms of trying to figure that out. I don't think I'll ever know, and I don't think anyone will. But I was curious about what your opinion on that is.
I'll put it to him, Jim. Thanks.
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, life after death, the belief in the soul that survives physical death is a hallmark of many religions. That is a phenomena that's really not addressable by science. Science believes in the physical world and believes pretty much that that's all there is. And when we have physical death, that's the end of us. So the belief in the soul is a non-scientific belief. You have to believe in that, in the soul, on the basis of faith. Either you have the faith or you don't have it.
One last question from George in Boston. George, go ahead. Hi.
Hi, Jen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This question has to do with miracles. I do believe in miracles. I've seen things that defy explanation. However, everybody's asking for miracles every day. And my problem with miracles is who gets them? You know, what's the selection criteria that a deity, presumably, may use to determine who gets a miracle and one person doesn't? Like, how does that work?
Do you have the answer, Alan?
I don't have the answer to that at all.
Good question, though,
George. I hope that you're one of those people who does get the miracle.
So listen, while we wrap up here, I'm interested who your literary influences are.
I have many. I love Italo Calvino, Salman Rushdie, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Virginia Woolf is one of my all-time favorites. Annie Proulx, Franz Kafka, Jose Saramago. Michael Ondaatje for the beauty of his language. These are some of my influences.
And what's next for you as far as writing? This is an unusual work for you, would you say? Ghost?
Well, I think there's some philosophical dimension to most of my books, as there is in this one. I've gone out on a limb a little bit with this book.
I'd say, yeah.
Well, I'm working now on a book-length poem, and I don't want to say more about it, but poetry was where I got my start in writing, and I think that even prose writers benefit from listening to the cadences and the rhythms of words. Poetry is a very important source, I think, for all writers.
I was thrilled to hear, but wanted to confirm that indeed you have sworn off email.
I have. Do you use email?
You know, when I said that to me in the meeting, I said, oh, that would be a dream of mine to be able to do that. And you're teaching still at MIT?
I'm teaching at MIT. I'm teaching, we have a graduate program in science writing, and I'm teaching in that program.
Do students come up to you after your classes and ask you about your thoughts beyond what you're teaching them scientifically?
Well, they do sometimes. I mean, I think a good student is always asking questions and pushing the envelope, so to speak. And I love to get into those kinds of conversations with students.
Well, Alan Lightman has been our guest. His new novel is Ghost. His novel Einstein's Dreams was an international bestseller. Of course, he's a teacher at MIT, has taught at Harvard, theoretical physicist and novelist. What a pleasure to have you on with us this hour. Thanks so much, Alan.
Pleasure to be here, Jane.
And best of luck to you in Cambodia and elsewhere.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.